And that's the classic response, is for people to say, oh, congratulations, you're done. And it's just the silliest concept. Like, I'm done. I'm bald and I'm sick and I have scars and something's oozing. And I, what do you mean I'm done? Like, I can't push a button. I'm just starting. It's like you're a baby again and you have to learn all these tasks over with your new cyborg body.
Kia ora and welcome back to the C Word, Kiwis Talk About Cancer. We're your hosts, Helen King
and Belinda Tran-Lawrence.
If you like what you hear today, please subscribe to us on iTunes or follow us on Spotify and come find us on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you and you'll be able to keep up with everything new from the show.
So this week we have a really special guest. She is our first person who is zooming in from overseas. She is in America. Grace is American. She was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2016 when she was only 35. Grace is the mother of three children and she decided to share her experience on an Instagram account. Her account, if you want to go and have a look and check it out, is called Grancer for Real. And in this, she documented the highs and lows of her treatment, which included a double mastectomy and chemotherapy.
Yeah, it's really cool to have Grace on the show. I followed her when I was having treatment, so it feels quite special to be able to talk to her about what her experience has been. Because one of the things that I think I know Belinda and I really identify with is that Grace really struggled with her identity when her treatment ended. She had a short documentary, Grace, that followed her preparation to get a mastectomy tattoo with David Allen.
And you're our first guest from overseas that we've had on the show, that we have on the show.
Oh, that's so exciting. Well, yeah. We should probably note that we're recording this on different days.
Yeah. It's just like Back to the Future. We got in the DeLorean. So Wednesday is okay. Unfortunately, Donald Trump is still the president. So yes, there is that. But Wednesday is okay so far.
I'll take it. That gives me hope for tomorrow.
So I am so excited to have you here, and we're both excited to have you here. You sort of came on my radar when I was going through cancer treatment in 2018, and I can't actually even remember how the Grace documentary kind of popped up. I think it was through Facebook, and I remember watching it and just feeling so sort of emotional, and you know those moments where you go, oh, you know, she gets it, this is exactly what it's like. And I love that you shared that story so openly, and I think one of the things that really struck me as I watched it was how you described the changes to your body. And I think that's something that so many of us experience, because breast cancer is so brutal to how it affects your body. And I'd love to know, has the way that you see your body or experience your body changed over time since then?
Yeah, it changes every day, honestly. It was like starting over with a brand new body. Suddenly I was a cyborg. You know, I used to just be a human, and then my own body attacked itself and cancer was created or activated, whatever happened. And then all of the chopping up and poisoning began, and suddenly I became a cyborg. Parts of me were not me anymore. They were artificial. And truly, I think of my mastectomy like an amputation. It is, I believe, technically an amputation. And you don't hear that term very often, I think, because it is just so brutal. But it's the removal of a body part. And yes, we replace it with something, but that's not your body anymore. It might be my skin, but I have no sensation whatsoever, even 4 years out. They feel heavy and weird and different and like this mechanical contraption has been put on me, even though they're just basically balloons of water. They're completely artificial. And so I feel like I'm carrying around, you know, this part of me that's just completely synthetic. And that is something I think about every day.
Mm. I feel like we've jumped straight into the really deep stuff.
It doesn't take long with me. I have.
Oh, no. We're the same. What you're touching on now. So this is, I've got to be careful here because this is kind of my area that I'm like extremely passionate about. And obviously, like all of us have been through it, have my own feelings and opinions and way of looking at it. And I love that so many of us are different. I've had a double mastectomy, but chose not to have a reconstruction. And I guess my question for you would be around, how do you feel the decisions you've made? I mean, you've talked about the fact that having reconstructed breasts is very different to how you were before. So your body has changed quite a lot. And how has that changed your ideas and your experiences of yourself as a woman, your femininity? Do you think about that in the same way as you used to think about that?
Not at all. It's totally different now. I don't know that I really thought of myself in terms of where I fell on the femininity scale before cancer. I identify as a woman. You know, I'm cisgender. I'm married to a man. I just felt like, I think, a regular old woman. And then suddenly when I was confronted with my femininity and the loss, potential loss of it, it really slammed into focus, and I had to sort of create a hierarchy of what mattered to me from the outside. On the inside, that was something that was going to take time to iron out how I sort of saw myself after this regeneration of my body from illness. But from the outside, I knew that I still wanted to have breasts. I knew I wanted to just look basically the same way I looked before. That's what I asked my plastic surgeon for. I said, I know I won't need to wear a bra because they're not going to move anymore. But if I did, I would want it to fit the same as my breast size before. I didn't want that to change. I just, so much was changing with my life that the outside, the actual way I would wear clothes, I wanted that to all be the same. And I don't really know why I felt that way, but it just was maybe something that wanted to be constant.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to ask. Did you feel like it was an area that you had an element of control and choice in when there were so many other areas that you didn't have that?
Yes, and that is a huge theme for me because I'm a bit of a control, I'm not going to say freak because that sounds negative, but a control, someone who desires control. Let's try that. And so all through this process, I really tried to create my own narrative with what was happening. And I did that through writing, which turned into my blog. I did it through how we explained it to the children and then sort of lived our lives as a family. I had to have that level of control. I wanted them to see it the way I wanted them to see it, not how they'd hear people talking about it or their friends' parents would say, oh, poor Grace, or your friend's mom, so sad. I wasn't going to have any of that. This was going to be something that I decided early on was going to be as fun as possible. And I know you're all thinking, okay, this woman's officially lost it. When you have kids who are 7, 5, and 2, you know, this can be defining to who they are for the rest of their lives. And I wanted it to, I knew it was going to be either way, but I wanted it to try to err on the side of, well, this was actually a good memory for them in a way. So I tried to make it as fun as possible all along the way. I let them pick what hairstyle I had before my hair fell out, and they picked a rainbow mohawk. So I got a rainbow mohawk, and I let them pull my hair off my head, and I let them come to chemo and bring brand new Lego sets. And so they have all of these really positive associations, and that's one of the things I feel best about with sort of my cancer legacy, is that I was able to control that narrative really quite well.
It's, I've been thinking as you're talking and about my own experience, and I think about that idea of your body changing, because I feel like my entire adult life has been about trying to accept myself and accept my body. And I've been a larger woman probably my, you know, my whole adult life. And before getting cancer, I'd lost a lot of weight. I'd grown my hair out and all of these things. I'd gone through a divorce, and I felt like I'd kind of, you know, been through this transformation. And then getting cancer threw me back into that. All the sort of ways that I related to my body or felt like I embodied femininity were then taken away, and being taken back into this place of, I don't know who I am anymore. I don't recognize this body anymore. And all the markers that say you are a woman weren't really there. So I had one breast taken and haven't had a reconstruction. And so that's, you know, a different experience in itself. And it's, yeah, I think it's hard to imagine just how much the breast cancer experience kind of influences and changes the way that we experience being women.
Yes, I had an interesting sort of opposite situation to what you were just describing. I really liked my plastic surgeon. I trusted him. He was great. And he did a really beautiful job, honestly. I had a nipple sparing mastectomy, so my nipples are there. They are permanently like mannequin pointing out nipples, which I don't love that part. They are there. And so all things considered, with these new silicone breasts that I have, they look good. They look really good. I mean, people see the way I look now, and I'm sure you've heard this many times from people in this community. People say like, oh, well, at least you got a free boob job. Your boobs look great.
Yeah.
Which is like the worst, you know, and I know they're well-meaning, but it's like, oh no, just stop talking. just zip it. Because that's not obviously what it is for us, but because mine look really good, I get a lot of compliments on them, and my bare breasts are even on my plastic surgeon's website, which is something. I'm not sure I have the words for that. I guess I signed a consent for that at some point, and I'm just too lazy to have them take it to my head's not in it. Thank God. But people will come at me with all this positivity and like, oh, wow, isn't that just a great turn of events? And you're like, no. They might look great, but I have no feeling. I won't let my husband touch them. I feels like a phantom limb. It's creepy in a way. And yes, I wear clothes nicely, but I had my breasts removed because I had a terrible disease. There's not a really good way to spin that.
No.
I was reading an interesting academic article this morning in New Zealand. Some New Zealand academics were looking into what they call the pinkification of cancer, of breast cancer. And the way because breast cancer does primarily affect our breasts, and breasts have real ideas about them within our culture and the way men think about them, the way women think about them, and how losing our breasts or having changes to them on everything we think about them, it's almost like that supersedes the fact that, hold on a tick, cancer? Like, cancer? This is actually not about boobs. This is about cancer.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, I don't know what your culture is like all the way down there on your special island. but on our big honking mainland here, you know, breasts have sort of become free game for American culture. Like, it's, people can talk about them in terms of just what they look like and that, not in connection to a body or a human. And that's really common and normal. And that is a real problem for me. I can't speak for anyone else going through breast cancer, but just because, you know, we highlight breasts in fashion magazines and they are something that we use to sell a lot of products, it's something we wear on the outside, right? It's not like you can make liver cancer chic. You can't see my liver, right? You can't like put a dress on it. But breasts, they're on the outside. So it's almost like they're open for commentary, for the taking. And then exactly like you said, Belinda, when you attach cancer to it, people sometimes just can't marry those concepts. And they can't think like why you wouldn't want to get them put back on. And I think any woman who's been through this can say, like, I can give you a bunch of reasons why you wouldn't put them back on.
Yeah. And my experience, I think, you know, plays into those. We're obsessed with breasts over here too. Yeah, absolutely. Definitely the breast worshipping here as well. And I really struggled for a very long time after I'd had my mastectomy, and I couldn't wear a prosthesis for a long time because I had this little piece of skin that was just not healing. And so, you know, as a bigger woman with no hair, one boob, I could not find clothes that I actually wanted to wear that felt like me anymore. I couldn't find lovely lingerie anymore because what was available for a big woman with one boob, just really ugly. And so I think it's not really been until this year where I started going, well, who, you know, what do I feel comfortable in? What, you know, what do I want to project to the world? Because for that first year after going through the cancer, I had no idea who I was. Nothing felt the same. I didn't feel the same. I didn't relate to the world the same as I had before. I sometimes feel like if I look at those pictures of me, even 6 months leading into the diagnosis, I don't recognize that person anymore as being me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel the same way. A little bit twisted, though, because my body does sort of look the same-ish, but the way I think is night and day. You know, I used to, I'm not going to say I was a guarded person because I've always felt comfortable speaking my mind. But, you know, I think I just fell into society's cogged wheel the way most people do. And then here trots along cancer and just like throws everything into a tailspin. It makes you confront the life you want to live, who you are intrinsically, what matters, all of these huge issues of basically mortality. And it gave me this, I'm going to say opportunity, which is a kind word for it, to reevaluate everything. And I came out of it on the other side. I think I have enough hindsight now at 4 years to really see at least the beginning of the change, but I live completely differently. I live the way I want to live. I do the things I want to do. If society doesn't like this mohawk hairdo I wear now. I mean, I drive a minivan with three little kids. Like, I am a suburban mom. And people see me pop out of the minivan, and I think they think I'm, like, the weird nanny. And I think that's great. I would love to be known as the weird nanny. That's amazing. I don't care what they think. I'm just glad that I can just look at myself in the mirror. I mean, the bar is lower at this point, but the living is better. Mm.
Helen, this is what we were talking about this morning, was it not? I was a little bit more crude in how I summed it up this morning. Something else was happening and which led us to this conversation. Basically, I was like, well, after cancer, there's no F's to give, is there? You realize that you want to live the way you want to live, and giving yourself permission to get up in the morning and go, what do I want? What do I need? And how am I going to make that happen for myself? And in some ways, cancer can be a really big gift. And I know that sounds super corny, and I'd be the first one to, you know, do the devil sign at anyone who said it to me. I feel like since we've actually had it, we can sometimes say that to ourselves.
Completely. Completely. I tell people that if I don't get cancer again, if this was it for me, it was worth it. Because I know I'm living a fuller life now. And again, so corny. But my little brush with mortality here has allowed me to just instantly prioritize what matters. And it's not fitting in to the way my peer group or, you know, society tells me I should be. It's just like, I don't know, I want to eat pancakes for dinner for a week. Fine. That's, I'm alive.
Yeah. No, definitely agree. And I think, and from what I gather, from what I glean, I've never been to America, but I get the impression that in America, that's a little bit harder to do. While obviously our cultures are similar, and there are similar threads here, I think there's less outright pressure to fit a certain norm. It's a little bit more accepted, I think, to live your life in different ways. Particularly if you don't live in Auckland. I don't live in Auckland. I think the pressure might be a bit more in Auckland, Ella. I live in the provinces. But from being part of breast cancer groups that are based in America, groups to do with no reconstruction, women who choose to live flat, they will often say that people feel that they can make comments about their bodies. People who don't know them, friends and family, strangers in the store, can actually comment on the fact that they've got no breasts. Whereas in New Zealand, I have never had that, and I'm pretty sure I probably will never have that.
Oh my gosh, that makes me so jealous and happy for you, because that is not what's going on here. We are judgy over here.
Oh, we're judgy. We just do it on the inside.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Let me rephrase that. We are judgy and boastful.
Yeah. We're too repressed to actually tell you what we think.
Yeah. Oh, man. Some of that British stuck with you guys, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but sometimes it's good. So we might think all sorts of negative things about the person next door, but we'll be lovely to their face.
Oh, isn't that a delight? We will not. We will talk about it on national TV.
Yeah.
Grace, do you want to tell us something about your story for our listeners who don't know so much about it?
Well, I was diagnosed at the age of 35. I have no genetic markers, no known genetic markers. I am one of those people that's like the hands up shrug emoji. Like, we don't know. You just got it. Sorry. And I'm lucky I even found it, because in America, we don't do baseline mammograms until you're 40. And I didn't even feel anything I actually just noticed that I was like about 18 months out from breastfeeding my last child, and I was still able to lactate on both breasts. And I was like, well, that's weird and kind of gross. So I spoke to my midwife, who was like, oh, that's fine. I wouldn't worry about it. And then I happened to mention to my doctor, my primary care physician, and she said, well, let's just do a baseline mammogram. And that's where they found it. I mean, it wasn't palpable. The tumor was so deep in my chest cavity that it probably wouldn't have been palpable until it was a devastating diagnosis. So I caught this disease completely on a fluke. And it turns out the lactation had nothing to do with it.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really wild. My father had died of cancer 2 years prior. And people would say to me all the time, like, oh, your dad's looking out for you from heaven. And I could just never let that one go, because I was like, my dad would never send me a message from heaven via my boobs. Sorry. Cute, but
weird.
That's not what that was. don't loop him into this.
Yeah.
So that's how my story started. And if I had to pick one thing to characterize my disease, I think it would just be the way that I needed to use humor through the process. That was the only way I could cope, was to try to make it funny. And there were certainly serious moments, of course, that just couldn't be spun. But if at all possible, I needed humor to get through this.
Yeah, I was similar. And because, I mean, chemo wrecked my body. I mean, the side effects from chemotherapy were horrific. And my partner and I had only been together for about 6 months before I was diagnosed with cancer. And all of a sudden we're faced with, do you want to have, because I don't have children. So it was like, do you want to have children or not? And now your partner has cancer, and now she doesn't have a breast, and all of those things we were facing. So sometimes we just had to laugh at what was going on, because cancer, basically, like, you lose all your dignity. You know, you just lose all your dignity. And so I kind of feel like we know a lot more about each other, and we can just kind of laugh at it. Because, I mean, it was things like my stomach used to make the weirdest noises. Like, it was like there was a dinosaur in there going, oh,
oh no.
Yeah, yeah. And just all these other things sort of happened that you couldn't hide from another person. And so you just have to laugh at the awful ridiculousness of what was going on.
It's true. The things that happen to your body are so bonkers. I mean, they're asinine. Like, there was a time right after my mastectomy where I remember going to a doctor's appointment, and two completely benign things happened that I was leaving the house, really, for the first time. I had to press a button in an elevator, and I couldn't do it. The muscles you use to press a button are completely just obliterated during a mastectomy. And I remember standing in the elevator, pointing my finger at the button and, like, almost starting to cry, because I was like, I can't push this goddamn elevator button. I'm 35 years old. And it's just absurd. You don't think about these little things. And then I went to the bathroom and I went to pump the soap. Oh my God, if you think pressing an elevator button is bad, try pumping soap after you've just had your pectoral muscles, like, ripped off, flipped up, melon balled out. I mean, it's just these moments where you're like, we really are fragile little creatures, because this is it's you need all these connective tissues and muscles to do all of these simple, simple human tasks. It threw me. I didn't quite realize the magnitude of that type of follow-up symptom.
No, and it's because I've noticed in, you know, in the documentary and things, it mentions boxing, and I boxed for a number of years, and it was such a huge part of my life, and chemo really kicked me. I was basically in bed for 4 months, and I could walk around my, you know, the house up the front of the little granny flat I was living in. I could sometimes walk to my local shops. That was it. I was not one of those people who could do any exercise. And it has taken, I actually don't think I'm there. I'm 2 years post diagnosis. And, you know, I walk the dog and sometimes I go for a bike ride and that's about it. And I've done boxing once with some friends since. And I was like, I almost cried because it was like, oh, wow, it's, you know, I can do it again. But I feel like the physical recovery is being so intense. I haven't been able to get that part of it back yet. I'm just not there.
Yeah, and that's so hard for people to understand because they think like, oh, the treatment's over. Like, just start doing it again. And that's just not the way it works. I think a lot of it depends on what type of exercise you were doing before you were diagnosed. Of course, you know, like a marathon runner is going to be a lot better equipped to start running again probably after this. But none of us were training to get cancer.
No, you know, that's very true. What would that look like? Training to get cancer and the toll it takes on your body, your mind, your soul, I reckon. We need time. We need time to be kind to ourselves and get over that. And it is not helped at all by people going, oh, you're done now. That's fantastic. Back to normal. No, it just doesn't work that way.
No, and that's the classic response is for people to say, oh, congratulations, you're done. And it's just the silliest concept. Like, I'm done, I'm bald and I'm sick and I have scars and something's oozing and I, what do you mean I'm done? Like, I can't push a button. I'm just starting. Yeah. It's like you're a baby again and you have to learn all these tasks over with your new cyborg body.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And of course how your story shows us as well is that whole idea of being done. Like, you're never done. You're never done with cancer. That's really not how life works anyway. And if people really thought about it, they would realize that you become something else. And in your story, Grace, you describe yourself as a cancer celebrity. How do I say that?
A cancer celebrity. Yes.
Okay. And that's part of what you became at the end of it. I was having a read through your blog, which is awesome. Are you still kind of feeling like you're in that space and wanting to remain in that space?
I love writing. It is the best therapy for me, although I obviously also have a therapist because, let's be honest, I mean, come on. But that's what I can do acutely to help myself. It is funny in the area where I live, I am like the cancer lady. You know, if someone's sister's cousin gets breast cancer, they will contact me. And that's because I put myself out there. I mean, I told my story raw. I mean, you know, there's nothing I could tell you that isn't already out there. And so it's a really cool thing that I can do that for people, but it's a huge responsibility because I sort of said like, oh, this is me giving it all to you. And then when someone comes to me, that's wonderful. And I try to give everything I can. But if you look at that exponentially over time and everyone's cousin's best friend, that's thousands of people. And I've really felt the burden of trying to keep up with these people and give them what they need, at least from their initial contact of me. But it's hard because I have my own life and my own kids and my own job. And
your own healing.
And my own healing. Mm-hmm. Yes. And every time I think like I've sort of filed away a little chapter of my own cancer for storage, long-term storage, someone will ask me something where I have to retrieve that. And I have to sort of walk that walk again. And I'm willing to do it. And I think it's good for me, but that doesn't mean I always enjoy it or it's easy. But I do think that's sort of my calling from all of this is that, you know, I always think those who can should, right? Like if you can be a surgeon and save people's lives, then you should, if you have the resources and the time and that's, you know, where your joy will be found. And I can talk about this disease and I can talk about all the nitty gritty stuff that happened to me. I don't suffer the niceties. I mean, I can get into it real quick and usually quicker than other people are comfortable with, just like with our conversation. Like I can't sugarcoat things. If you're going to ask me something, even if it's like a veiled question, I'm going to know what you mean and I'm going to go right into it.
That's what we like here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It takes so much time.
I know, doesn't it? People waste so much time on the niceties.
Yeah.
Forget it. When we're talking about a deadly disease, it's like we can skip the niceties and go straight to like, how do you survive XYZ chemo surgery, whatever it may be. So it's a lot for me. And I thought it would lessen over time, and it has in some ways, but I think sort of the exponential spread of people knowing that I'm open and I've been through this keeps it pretty constant. And I still write about the disease, not as much. Thank goodness I don't have as much material because it's not as fresh. But I just, you know, wrote a blog the other day, and every time I hear from at least a couple people who say like, thank you so much for saying this out loud, because I can't, I'm just not that type of person. I couldn't talk about my disease with my family, but I was able to read what you wrote and send it to my family and say, this is how I feel.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
To know that I can give that to even a couple people, it is very rewarding.
Cause that's how Belinda and I met. Cause we've actually never met in person.
I can't believe this. Is it going to be filmed when it happens? Is there going to be a crew?
Yeah, maybe New Zealand, one of New Zealand's two radio TV stations might want to film us.
Come on, guys. Let's get them on the horn.
Yeah.
How far apart physically are you?
Not that far apart, but we've had COVID and everything, you know. We're 5 hours drive apart, and it will happen, and I'm sure it will happen this year. But, you know, we go through lockdowns and all of this, so. And besides, you know, we've had cancer, so we're not eager to catch a virus.
No.
That is a good point.
But I think you're right about those who can should, because I feel like for me, I'm a storyteller. I feel that, you know, I didn't train to be anything useful. I'm not a nurse. I'm not a teacher.
Storytelling is useful.
But, you know, like I can't save the world, but I can tell my story and connect with other people and that's what I think brought Belinda and I together, was that recognition of a shared experience. And like when I saw your documentary, it was like, oh, thank God someone else is saying that out loud. And it takes that isolation and, the alienation, isolation away from what you're experiencing.
I'm sorry, I have to just laugh because just now, you said something about, I think, a shared experience, but with your accent, to me, it sounded like you said a shit experience. And I honestly blanked out on everything you said afterwards because I was like, I'm not sure if she said shit experience or shared. I just don't know, but they both work.
It does. But we've done this before where, what was I saying the other week? It might just be my Kiwi accent because I said, we recommend having a routine. But Belinda thought I said rooting. So rooting here is slang for having sex. And so she's sitting there thinking, is she recommending that people improve their day by rooting?
Well, you know, it's a good recommendation because we were talking about things that help. So
listen, it takes all kinds. You know, you do what you got to do to get through the day.
Oh, but that, people, is a subject for another show.
Yes, it is.
Yes, no, it really is. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Now I've got, you know, those giggles when you laugh really hardly about something.
Yeah.
Grace, there was something that I wanted to ask you, kind of just following on from what you were just talking about feeling like you can, so you should.
Mm-hmm.
And because we just said it's great that everyone's different, I feel like I should put it out there that I don't actually agree with either of you on this one. I don't think you should just because you can. I think we need to give ourselves permission to do what we want to do sometimes rather than what we potentially should do. I was a secondary school teacher before I got cancer, and I'm a good secondary school teacher, and there's a big, I've had to fight against that part of me that goes, I should be doing it because I'm good at it. It's important. I make a difference to young people, but at the moment, I'm just not there. There's not enough of me that feels like I have that energy to be in a classroom. So I'm trying to give myself permission to go for walks on the beach and travel with my husband. And yes, I do still work, but yeah. Okay. I've gone off on a tangent. That's not what I was going to ask you.
Well, I think that's a really valid point though. And I'm glad you brought it up because of course there's the caveat to, if you can, you should, that only if it fulfills you.
Yeah,
right.
If
the thing you can do is like dig really good holes, I don't think you should necessarily do that because that probably isn't fun or really good for anybody. You know, there has to be this sort of marriage of, can you do it? Do you want to do it? And
yeah,
greater good. What's the big picture?
Yeah.
And of course, we're complex people. We're perfectly capable of holding two ideas in tension like that. So, yeah, I guess I just kind of thought, oh, I'm going to throw that out there. But my main question was around, in one of your last blog posts that I was reading, you were talking about the difficulty of trying to do it all and how you felt like you were flying apart. And you were searching for a solution, but I don't think I read anything after that that said what solution you actually found. So I was like, oh, I wonder what she came up with.
Well, drum roll, please.
Okay,
there's no solution, guys.
Oh.
I'm so sorry. I have not broken the code of how to live your best life.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I know that's a letdown, but I'm trying. I guess the solution for me right now is to live through each day, and that's kind of it. I'm not looking big picture right now. Everything's different because we're living amongst a deadly pandemic. And for those of us who have already faced a real glimpse of our mortality, we're probably a little bit better at pandemicking than most, because we've kind of done this once. Yeah. You know, we've already self-quarantined and stayed in our houses and not seen people and faced really scary things. Like, we're the ones who are best at this situation in some ways, at least best trained just by experience. And where that has brought me right now is that I don't know what I'm going to do for the holidays. I don't have any idea, you know, what my career will be like next summer. I know that I can baby step through the rest of today. I know I can do that. And I can wake up tomorrow and do it again. And that's how I'm living these days, is truly day to day. And people say, well, aren't you worried about, you know, what's going to happen when the weather gets cold again and the flu comes back and the kids can't be in school? And I say, no, I'm not worried about that, because I don't have space in my brain for that right now. I have to worry about my own health, the health of my family, the things that I can control. And that's it. That's all I got.
Yeah. I think that is kind of figuring it out in a way.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's figuring it out too. And isn't that what cancer teaches us all? It's like, I got this. I don't have to have anything other than this. You've got young children. Are you guys locked down where you are?
We're not. I wish we had national leadership that had us all doing the same thing, but we don't. It's basically state by state, and there are 50 of us and some provinces, so we're all winging it and we're all doing different things, and it's making it very hard because, you know, I live in Illinois and there are currently like 16 states that if I were to travel to them, I'd have to self-quarantine upon getting back here. But every state has their own version of that. So we're just like this super disjointed area where like no one really knows what to do or what's right, or states are just making things up and then one will fail and we'll be like, well, don't do what they did. So right now my state, most public schools are not open and most people are working from home if possible. But the public school in my area is open and I actually work at a public school. So I am not only sending my kids to a public school, but I am working in a public school in a health office, no less.
That's an interesting situation.
Yes, it is. But it goes back to what we were just talking about. I'm not really afraid of this disease. I'm afraid of the chaos that surrounds the disease. I'm afraid of how everyone's acting like untethered from the earth. Diseases I can handle it to a certain degree. I mean, at some point the disease is in charge, but I feel like I've done this once. I'm in good health, thank goodness. I take care of myself in the sense that I don't eat a bag of Cheetos a night, though I would like to. I try not to. And I do go to the boxing gym and do all of those things. So I feel like, you know what, I've done this once. I'm better equipped. So I'm going to just do it.
Yeah. Hey, Grace, it's so amazing to be able to talk to you and listen to your story and insights. Thank you so much for joining us in the future. It's a pleasure to have had you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me in the future. You guys make the future look very bright.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We have a special thing we have to do in today's show. So for those of you who have not yet realized, we are running a Pledge Me campaign. We need some funds, basically. We need some funds to keep going and to get some good equipment and to start promoting ourselves a little bit more. And we had our first what are we, funder, donator, person who pledged us funds, which we were very, very excited. I was out walking and Helen messaged me and went, we've got our first donation. So the way it works is if you donate us $20, we agree that we will shout out to you on our show. I don't know if that's a little bit of an 80s term, shout out. I don't know if all the cool kids use that these days, but we, you know, we still are. So Louise Bobbitt, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. You made us very, very happy. You were our first donator. Our first $20 came into our future coffers so that we can get some more film gear. Thank you very, very much. We think you are supporting an awesome project.
Yes, thank you, Louise. We love you. Awesome to have your support. So, please jump on to our link that we'll put up on Facebook. So it is called Operation Spread the C Word, which is cancer, not COVID, chlamydia, or anything else that's terrible.
Although cancer is terrible too.
Cancer is terrible, and I sometimes think it could be a four-letter word. You're right. But is it worse than chlamydia?
Yes, I think it's worse than chlamydia. Although, you didn't partake in any fun activities to get it.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Yeah, okay, that's true. Anyway, so we broadcast every Sunday at 11:55 a.m. live on Auckland's 104.6 FM. Or you can listen to us anytime at planetaudio.org.nz/thecword. You can listen back to all of our shows or subscribe and follow us on iTunes and Spotify. Thanks for listening and see you next time.
See you next time.